And presents Just Love, a conversation on the church's social mission with Monsignor Kevin Sullivan.
I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is our weekly conversation about the church in the world. So just love, just do it. Just love God, just love your neighbor, and love yourself, and our world will be more just and more compassionate. You know, as we are in the middle of August, we also are at a time when there, you know, a lot of kind of things seem to happen in August, and a lot of anniversaries and stuff like that. And so we have the Voting Rights Acts of 1965. We also kind of had the situation of the riots in Watts in August. And I think some of the issues surrounding our urban city, our urban areas in the United States, are very much part of on our agenda these days. And whether it's the issues of inequality, which are important issues, whether it be the issues of the police and communities, issues of voting. I think there are a lot of issues that are on the agenda these days. And so today on Just Love, we're going to speak about a couple of those issues, which are critically important. We're going to speak, our first guest in a few minutes, we're going to speak with Dr. George Kelling, who has written on community policing, broken windows theory. And so we're going to talk with him about that. And then we're a little bit later on in the show, we're going to speak about voting and the voting rights stuff with Professor Jeffries, who is at Ohio State University in the Department of History, who will kind of look at some of the issues related to voting, Voting Rights Act, and recent Supreme Court decision, which kind of took away part of that Voting Rights Act as being no longer necessary. So that's what we're going to do this week. So Tom, in these lazy days of August, what are you up to be lazy?
Well, to be lazy, Monsieur, you know, you were mentioning how during the summertime there's a lot of anniversaries that wind up taking place. And one of the things, one anniversary that, you know, is not necessarily widely celebrated in the United States, but I think in certain parts of the world is Indian independence, which this past week on August 16th.
Now, again, for our listeners, we got to make sure what we're talking about, because we use the word Indian to refer to Native Americans,
yes,
in the United States. You're talking about Indians from Asia.
Correct. South Asia, I should say, South Asian Indians. Yes. So it would be
because you got to be careful, because even though Angie, who's here, she being from Texas,
yes,
she thinks of cowboys and Indians, but she knows enough that it's about Native Americans, right?
That's right. Yes, I would say, well, this would be, yes, I would say, because there's the South Asian, and then there's obviously the Native American Indians, but this would be the South Asian Indians.
Okay, so what's going on with
they
that?
Had their Independence Day on August 16th. And in New York, one of the things that they wound up happening was they had a wonderful parade that went from...
I'm going to put you on the spot. So what did they become independent from?
They became independent from Great Britain. I think it was, and I think it was 19, I believe it was 1949. This is really pulling it out.
I'll give or take a year or so.
I think it was 1949 that they became independent of Great Britain, and I think at that point it was both India and Pakistan together became independent simultaneously.
Good.
And I think at that point, but certainly the Indian subcontinent became independent from Great Britain at that point. And they have in New York a wonderful parade that goes from, I'd say, 42nd Street down to 23rd Street, down to Madison Square Park. And I found myself there on Sunday, Monsignor. And this past Sunday, it was very warm, but it was a wonderful crowd. They had great food that they were giving away to folks.
Really?
Yeah, it was
free
great.
Food.
Free food.
You didn't tell Angie. You didn't tell me.
I'm sorry. You know, I
that there's free food.
Well, you know, I mean, the problem when you talk about free, when you tell people about free food, that means then there's less for you. You have to remember.
Oh,
that.
So now we're called. We're going to change. Angie, the show next week is going to be called Just Selfish, named in Tom. So we just wanted now, people from Texas, people from Texas are very generous, aren't you?
We're very nice.
Yeah, you want to share everything because you have so much.
Yes, I'm not used to this, Tom.
No, I know, Angie. I'm sorry. Well, I'm born in the Bronx, so I
want to say sometimes,
you know, sometimes I say only the strong will survive. So that's sort of the situation from there. But
I don't know.
But it was really fun once here. It was a nice parade, and the food was excellent. The food was very good.
Were there bands?
There were bands. There was dancing. They had a they actually had a stage down on 23rd Street that was set up that did both. They had Indian folk dancing and they had modern dancing from Bollywood, and it was really quite an event. And it was and it went from like 2:30 to 6. So
wow,
it was the whole day.
Well, whole day.
The whole
day.
It was really fun.
Good. So listen, why don't we go to our first guest? Our first guest is Dr. George Kelling, who is the senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, and we're going to speak with him about criminal justice. We're going to speak about policing. And so, Dr. Kelling, thank you so much for joining us on Just Love.
Thank you for having me.
Great. So, you know, you've written a lot about policing. You've written about a broken windows theory. But so, Dr. Kelling, how'd you get in, how did this particular topic kind of interest you? How'd you get involved in this?
Well, actually, I'm a social worker. And I was a practicing social work in Milwaukee during the 1960s when, as you know, there was a great deal of action regarding police. There were the civil disturbances. There were the anti-Vietnam War riots. There were policing was a very hot issue at the at that time. And the Ford Foundation had created what was called the Police Foundation, the National Police Foundation, and they were looking for people to evaluate projects. And I had some interest in that, and it turned out to be a career that started during the very early 1970s and has continued up to the present time.
And you probably needed a job, and you wanted to pay the rent, pay the mortgage.
Well,
so
it helped.
Yeah, of course. When I do my orientation for people at Catholic Charities, I thank them for lending their talents to Catholic Charities, and I hope that it's a good professional career for them. And I thank them because they probably had options. And I said, but you got to take a job someplace if you want to pay the rent and kind of eat. And that's, you know, not a bad motivation for doing that. So you pleased that you chose this field of study to kind of do a lot of work in?
Well, yes, it's been very satisfying for me. From the very beginning, I was involved in research that tended to point to some of the frustrations with policing during the 1960s and 1970s, and did some of the early research. And then slowly, as new ideas about policing started to develop during the 1980s, excuse me, I think I was able to contribute to that in the early conversations about community policing.
So Dr. Kelling, you mentioned, what were some of the frustrations that kind of were in the 60s?
Well, first of all, the African-American community at that time, as you remember, every civil disturbance at that time that in the African-American community was the result of a police-citizen interaction. And African-Americans simply said at that time they simply were no longer going to be policed the way they were being policed at that time. And so they rebelled against the police. And so that was one major concern. I think a second major concern was that their tactics of riding around in cars and responding to calls for service simply didn't make any difference. Police had moved off the streets, moved into cars, and I think there was this feeling in communities, I think, ranging from, well, it doesn't matter what kind of community, but especially in minority communities where crime started to escalate, that police had abandoned other traditional functions and were just cruising in cars with no effect. I think those were.
Let me, just for our listeners, so they get a sense of the history, because I think there's I don't want to say a mythology, but you know it's in movies and it's in books and things like that, the cop on the beat, and that is almost to a certain extent the myth of what police in urban areas are. It's the cop walking the beat. But when would you say, kind of from your looking at this historically, did things begin to change where you had fewer cops on the beat and more cops in the cars?
I think that started during the 1940s, got speed in the 1950s. And by the 1960s, in most communities, if there was foot patrol, it would be kind of a punishment beat. Politicians called for the cop on the beat and citizens called for it, but police thought it was a waste of time. And I think part of the move towards community policing was not just towards community policing, but the idea was that just having police ride around in cars simply wasn't satisfactory. They cars could be used to respond to calls, cars could be used to go to places to do policing, to do police work, but just riding around in cars had very little benefit.
Okay, and that would have been kind of something that began to be prevalent in the 60s, 70s, right?
That's right. It was the first round of research about this really started during the early 1970s, and then there was some research on foot patrol in Newark and Flint, Michigan, that suggested that if you had foot patrol, in Flint there was a decline in crime, but fear of crime declined a great deal when you had foot patrol, and appreciation for police increased a great deal, especially in minority communities, because at that time both Flint and Newark were predominantly minority communities in an age when there were still predominantly white cops.
We're speaking with Dr. George Keller, who is a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, and he has written a lot about policing, broken windows, community policings. Hey, Dr. Keller, you actually walked the beat, didn't you, in Newark?
Well, yeah, I spent a lot of time walking with foot patrol officers in Newark and in other cities in New Jersey. But more than that, I also spent a lot of time meeting with citizens in church basements, in their living rooms, in social centers, listening to what their concerns were, listening to the things that they had to tolerate, listening to victims who lived in constant fear, who didn't think they could protect their children or protect their property. So it was not just that I spent a lot of time with police. I spent a lot of time in the community listening to their concerns and their demands as well.
You know, when I was reading a little bit about this and you're walking the beat and things like that, it kind of what I thought about was that, you know, if you're walking the beat right with the police, you are not only talking to the police, you're speaking to people who are in the community, because that's why you're walking the beat.
Sure,
to interact with the people who are there.
Sure you are, and police are too. When they're riding in cars, they tend to spend a lot of time talking to their colleagues in the car. When they're out of the cars, by the very nature of the fact that they're interacting with citizens, they get to know people ultimately by name, and so it's much more turning to citizens for information, for approval, for collegiality.
So, Dr. Kelly, now let's move a little bit further and let's get into this notion of broken windows, and give our listeners the 3-sentence version of what does it mean. That's obviously a phrase, but what does it mean?
Well, broken windows is a metaphor that says that just as a broken window left untended and is a sign that nobody cares and leads to more damage, so disorderly behavior and conditions left untended is a sign that nobody cares and leads to fear of crime, more serious crime, and ultimately urban decay. The first part, very few people would disagree with. The dispute has come about two things. First of all, how it's practiced and whether it has an impact on crime. And that's been what the debate has been recently, especially in New York City.
Well, you know, it's interesting, Kel. When I was kind of thinking about this myself, I said, you know, I guess if I was to kind of translate it, and we're using metaphors and analogies, it's like a little bit like a stitch in time saves 9.
I would say so. It says that small things matter, and that something has to be done about it. Now, that something doesn't have to be necessarily police work. The graffiti on subway trains, I don't know whether you were in New York during the late 1980s.
I was.
1990s.
You know what happened? No other city would have me.
Yeah.
So I've lived in New York for my whole life.
Well,
I mean, I wanted to go to Austin, but Angie, who's here running the board, she made sure the people of Austin said, nah, keep them in New York.
Well, then you saw the graffiti.
Oh, boy.
The graffiti wasn't solved by police. It was solved by maintenance, by good planning on the part of President Gunn of the Transportation Authority, and good maintenance practices. So the idea that only police deal with minor problems, I think, has been a very bad idea, and has been a kind of a misrepresentation of what James Q. Wilson, my co-author, and I intended at the time.
Yeah, it's interesting because I do remember living in New York City, and I was actually living in a church up in Washington Heights. And, you know, the whole idea was if some graffiti got on a church building, you wanted to paint it immediately
right.
so that the whole building didn't get filled
right.
with graffiti.
Right. That's the basic approach towards it. But it says that that these minor things are disturbing to people. And all you have to do right now is go to some of the toughest areas of Detroit, where I've been, Chicago, Milwaukee, where I just was a few days ago, talk to citizens. And if you ask them what their problems are, at least three of the top five, and maybe even four, will be matters of disorder, aggressive panhandling, prostitutes harassing husbands in front of their wives and children. Those youths drinking in parks, those are the kinds of things that people are worried about and talk about because they see them as precursors to more serious crime and feel exposed and vulnerable as a result of those activities. Now, some of those problems, panhandling, don't necessarily need to be dealt with by police. They can be dealt with in other ways. And ultimately, what I've advocated and broken windows, as I've theorized about it, means you're really supporting the informal control of neighborhoods and communities. But that means that you've got to be very close to neighborhoods and communities, talking with them, understanding what their problems are. You're not imposing order. You're helping the community to maintain order.
You know, Dr. Kelly, I think what you're saying to me seems to make just so much sense, and that it's not merely about the police. It's about kind of the whole community trying to deal with a more orderly, a more secure area.
Yeah.
It's interesting. And what happens sometimes is you get a good idea and then you figure out how to implement it. And I think, you know, one of the people who taught me actually just passed away, professor at NYU, Dennis Smith.
Yes, I knew Dennis well.
Yeah. He always would talk about Comstat and stuff
yeah.
like that. And, I mean, you do get police commissioners who their definition or the way they communicate is that they relate their arrests for misdemeanors with the crime rate. And, you know, in a world where you're always looking for metrics,
you know,
sometimes people run with the metrics
yep.
and they don't see the fuller picture.
Yep, and that is, and especially if informally or formally quotas get set, and that is, you say, we want so many stop, question, and frisk, or we want so many arrests, you're headed for trouble under those kinds of circumstances because they're easy to provide, and yet they can be done in ways that breed a lot of resentment, and I think we've seen that in New York City, and I think Commissioner Bratton right now is working hard to undo that impact and to a return to a more civil relationship between the police and citizens, one that, again, they're working together to co-produce order and co-produce low crime rates rather than, again, police imposing things.
You know, let me ask you your opinion on this, because it's something as I said, no other city would have me. So I've lived in New York City forever. But I have relatives who live all in the New York metropolitan area, in Connecticut, New Jersey, you know, outside of New York City. And so I wind up going there for holidays and other things. And it's pleasant and it's nice, but it's a different community, different feel sometimes. One of the things I've always thought, and this is my opinion, but I'm asking you since you know something, I just kind of don't know anything, is, what about the notion that the police should live in the city where they police?
I think that would be very desirable. I think, however, in a time when both members of the family are working, that becomes kind of hard to enforce.
Yeah, it does.
I think the more familiar officers can be with the territories that they police, the better off they are and the better off the territory is. I mean, an extreme example is I've been in communities where police were walking the beat in Spanish-speaking communities, and they couldn't speak Spanish. Well, that doesn't work very well if you have to constantly rely on a translator. So again, the more familiar police can be with their neighborhoods and the more they work directly with neighborhoods and understand the communications, the better off. Now, that doesn't mean that non-Spanish speaking police can't work in those communities, but to the extent that they speak the language, to the extent that they are familiar with the culture, the better off everyone is going to be.
We're speaking with Dr. George Keller, who is a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute and somebody who has done a lot of study, both book-wise, study-wise, and actually, quote-unquote, walking the beat and learning about police and communities. So let me ask you this. I've heard Commissioner Bratton in New York City talk about this kind of new notion of community policing. I'm sure you're familiar with that.
Yes.
And again, what's your thought? In step in the right direction?
Oh, absolutely. I the commissioner back in the 1970s, when he was in Boston, when he was a sergeant, when he was a lieutenant, he started something that every police administrator should do.
You know, I have to interrupt you.
Yeah.
I mean, the biggest problem we have right now in New York City is we have a mayor and a police commissioner who have Boston roots, and the mayor, at least, is unabashedly still a Boston Red Sox fan. I don't see how they can govern.
Oh, do I understand that?
But yeah. Anyway, I'm sorry. I interrupted
well,
you.
Well, that's all right. But he's been working on the idea of neighborhood policing and community policing since the very early days during the 1970s in Boston. And I think I think when he was here, when he was in New York the first time, it was his goal then to move towards community policing as he got what he calls the peace dividend. And that was as crime declined, there was less demand for dealing with complicated homicide cases, et cetera. That gave opportunities to relate to the community in new terms. Now, unfortunately, he and Giuliani didn't get along very well. He went his way and Giuliani went his. But I think in some respects, the commissioner is now finishing what he started earlier, and that is a shift towards community-based policing in which officers work closely in neighborhoods with residents to co-produce order and low crime rates. And I think he's a firm believer in this, and it has been characteristic of all his efforts. Remember, when he took over Los Angeles, probably the Los Angeles Police Department, the LAPD perhaps had the worst relationship with the African-American community than any police department in the country. And yet by the time he left, they had a working relationship and the African-American community was solidly in back of him in terms of the kind of reforms that he brought into the LAPD. So even though we're having conflict at the present time, I have great confidence that the commissioner will achieve in New York what he achieved in Los Angeles and began in New York the first time around.
Hey, I just want to thank you so much. You've been so generous in in giving us your time, your expertise, and I learned a whole lot. I'm sure our listeners did. Thanks for the work you've done, and thanks for being a guest on Just Love.
Thank you for having me. I enjoyed talking with you.
Dr. George Kelly, senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, professor of criminal justice, and we've learned a lot about community and policing, the role of police walking the beat, getting closer to the community, dealing with little things to prevent bigger crime. So we're going to take a break. Join us when we come back on Just Love. Just do it. Just love God. Just love your neighbor. Just love yourself, and our world will be more just and more compassionate. This is the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
One day, when the glory comes, it will be ours, it will be ours. Oh, one day, when the war is won,
welcome back to Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is our weekly conversation about the church and the world. Just love. Just do it. Just love God. Just love your neighbor. Just love yourself. And our world will be more just and more compassionate. You know, Tom, I'm on my cold turkey break, right? Because no more paying attention to presidential politics until January, because it's useless. It doesn't make any difference. The polls are all spun, all of that. You know, we got more important things to do. It's the ice cream time.
That's
people
right.
Getting ready for school. All of those things. More important.
Much.
Back again in January when kind of they begin the primaries, the caucuses. Then we pay a little attention, see what's going on then. But, I mean, for now, we got other things to do.
Absolutely, Mr.
So,
I agree.
So what's going on in the world that we should let our listeners know?
Well, this week, you know, we were mentioning a little bit about the important things in the world. And one of the things that was just celebrated this past Wednesday was World Humanitarian Day. It's celebrated by the United Nations.
Who makes all these things
up? This is the UN General Assembly, Monsignor. Actually, this one is based in
the only day I paid
truth.
Attention to recently was Left-Hander Day.
Yes, that was this past
week. We are so picked on and exploited. We left-handed people that you need a day to do it. Angie, I don't even know. Are you left-handed or right-handed?
I'm right-handed.
You're right-handed? Well, you have an advantage. I mean, that's why we left-handed people do better in the world, because we always have to struggle.
Well, now that I know that you're left-handed, I can't work for you anymore.
Bye. Bye.
It's over. It's done.
It's over? It's
I'm
over.
Sorry.
But at least you're not a Boston Red Sox fan.
No.
Are you a sports fan?
Football.
Football?
Cowboys? Yeah.
Oh. Okay. You're a Cowboy fan. I like the Cowboys.
Good answer.
Here's a true story. Mm-hmm. So we had our annual Catholic Charities meeting in Fort Worth about 3 or 4 years ago. And there's somebody who works with me who wakes up in the morning, has breakfast, is a Dallas fan, lunch is a Dallas fan, dinner, just absolute Dallas fan. She wouldn't let us leave Fort Worth without going to visit the stadium. I took a tour of the stadium.
How was it? You like it?
Phenomenal. Mm-hmm. It was phenomenal. It was a great. Have you been to the stadium?
I actually haven't.
Oh!
I know. I need to go. I watch it on TV all the time. I've just never been in person.
All right. No, I've been. It's nice. It is a phenomenal stadium. I think they told me. I'm not sure I'm true about this, but that if you laid down the Empire State Building on its side, it would like kind of just about fit in the stadium.
Big.
Yeah.
Wow. That is an interesting fact.
Yeah.
And I'm from Texas, and I didn't even know that.
Somebody look that up. But it's like, it's one of those real, it's so big that you could put a big building in it. So it's whatever. So anyway. But National Humanitarian.
Well, it's World Humanitarian Day. This one actually was decided by the United Nations General Assembly, Monsignor. And what it commemorates is, I don't know if you recall, back in 2003, the United Nations headquarters in Baghdad was bombed. And 123 people died that worked for the United Nations. And at that point, it was a very sad event. And it was on August 19th that occurred. So the General Assembly, in kind of to honor them, decided to make this World Humanitarian Day. And on this day, there's themes they have every year. The first one was in 2009. This year's theme was Inspiring the World's Humanity. And what they did was they encouraged people from around the world to share social media of various people doing humanitarian work. So, for example, on your Facebook page, if you have one, or your Twitter account, or one of those things, you were supposed to put up an action of someone who was doing something for others, they were putting themselves out and they were actually doing something for others. So this was, you know, a worldwide event. The United Nations wound up putting it forward.
Okay. Well, okay. But since you've mentioned social media, I want to tell our listeners, because this is really exciting. You know, the Pope's coming to the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. He's coming to he's going first to Cuba, then he's going to Washington, come to New York, and then Philadelphia, okay? So I think we should welcome the Pope, don't you?
Sure, of course, okay. Absolutely.
So what we did at Catholic Charities is we created a website, which is called Charity Has No Boundaries.
Okay? I like it.
And listeners, you can Google it. Charity Has No Boundaries. In honor of Pope Francis, which basically saying we should be reaching out to everybody, and our charity shouldn't be narrow and limited, but it has no boundaries. And so we created that website in which everybody in the whole country, anybody wants to, can go to the website and make their own little video and upload it to the site. And we'll put it on the site. Like, you can do 30 seconds of welcoming Pope Francis. And what we're encouraging people to do as part of their welcome, to include those verses from Matthew's gospel. When I was hungry, you gave me to eat. Mm. When I was thirsty, you gave me to drink. When I was a stranger, you welcomed me. And so we are encouraging people to kind of do those videos so that we welcome Pope Francis. And when he comes to New York, we're going to put them together and we're going to give him a copy of all those welcoming things. So all listeners, just go to the site, Charity Has No Boundaries, and you can upload your own video. And we actually kind of got a few people who did their own videos already. So Stephen Colbert did a video.
Very cool.
He did one. Whoopi did one. Whoopi Goldberg did one. Who else did one? Oprah did one. Oprah Winfrey did one. so we got a bunch of people. Then we got some politicians who did it. You know, both Republicans, Democrats. Hillary Clinton did one.
Okay.
She did one. Nancy Pelosi did one. Mm-hmm. And we got the people, the governor of New York State did one.
Okay.
And so we got a bunch of videos and ordinary people, we got kids doing it. So go to the video. Charity has no boundaries. And you give your welcome to Pope Francis, and we'll upload it, and it'll be on our video, and you can say hello and welcome to Pope Francis.
That's awesome, Monsieur. I think I'm going to do that myself.
You should do it.
I will. It's easy to do. And you
know
should
what?
Too.
I think what we'll do is we'll take a break, and when we come back, we'll speak with our next guest, who is, Professor Jeffries, who is from Ohio State University, and we're going to speak about voting rights stuff. So this is the Catholic Channel. This is Just Love. Just do it. Just love God. Just love your neighbor. Just love yourself. And our world will be more just and more compassionate. Join us when we come back on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
One day, when the glory comes, it will be ours, it will be ours. Oh, one day, when the war is won, we will be sure.
Welcome back to Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is our weekly conversation about the church in the world, Just Love. Just love God, just love your neighbor, just love yourself. And what we do is we explore those topics which talk about how we make our world a better place. And not merely only as individuals, what we do to be charitable, as important as that is, but what we do as a society, how we kind of organize ourselves, what are the policies that we put in place, the programs we do in order to make sure that there is justice, there is compassion in our world. And, you know, we consider rights to be very important because we believe that the human person made in God's image and likeness deserves to have their human rights respected. And so therefore, our society should organize itself in a way that as many of those rights can be respected, whether it's the right to eat, the right to housing, the right to being secure. All those rights are important. And so those are the topics we talk about here on Just Love. We talk about them with the people who are doing a lot of the day-to-day work, hands-on, and those people who are doing the work of helping us to think about it, to get it right, to frame the issues in order that we can do that better as a country. And so today I'm just absolutely delighted that we're going to be speaking with Professor Jeffries, who is an associate professor at Ohio State University in the Department of History. And we're going to be speaking with him about the Voting Rights Act, which has undergone a little bit of change recently because of a decision of the Supreme Court. And so I'm delighted that Professor Jeffries is with us. Professor Jeffries, thank you for joining us on Just Love.
Thank you, Monsignor Sullivan. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Great. So you're a very, very important guest because you're in Ohio, right?
I am.
And quite frankly, you, I think, and the people in Florida and every now and then the people in Pennsylvania, you're the only people whose votes count in presidential elections, as far as I can tell. Your economies really thrive because of the amount of time and money that the candidates spend in your places. So congratulations for being at the center of the presidential race.
Well, I tell you, having grown up in New York, it wasn't until I moved to Ohio that I realized presidential elections actually occurred. So you're absolutely right. Ohio is one of the major swing states, and so a lot of money and a lot of energy is pumped into the elections here.
But you know, Professor Jeffries, from New York, they come here to zip code 10128 to pick up the money that they then dump in Ohio.
That makes sense.
But so they take our money and they give it to Ohio. And anyway, but hey, thanks so much for being. Where'd you grow up in New York?
Crown Heights.
Just down
from Eastern Parkway and Nostrand Avenue.
Well, you know, I'm old and decrepit these days, but 4 million years ago when I was in college, I worked in Brownsville.
Oh, wow.
And I worked there because we worked for an organization which you're probably familiar with, the Fresh Air Fund.
Of course, yeah.
And so we worked. I worked there for 3 summers. I actually lived in Brownsville around 1970, around that time. And I got to tell you, it was a very, very good experience. I wouldn't give it up for anything in the world. It was a little bit wild and woolly, though, as you were living there. But so I got a fond place in my heart for Brooklyn. And just for a moment, the rest of the country doesn't need to know this, but you know, I couldn't figure out Brooklyn until I learned that every street at some point or the other crossed either Eastern Parkway, King's Highway, or Flatbush Avenue.
There you go. that's the Ark of the Covenant right there.
That certainly is. So give our listeners a little sense of your own kind of little personal history. How'd you wind up going from Crown Heights to Ohio State?
Well, I headed south after I graduated from high school. I headed south to Atlanta, attended Morehouse College, and then did my graduate work state south in at Duke University. And began my research on civil rights and the civil rights movement in Alabama, focusing specifically on Alabama and rural Alabama. And then taught for a year once I finished up my PhD, taught for a year at the University of Alabama, and then headed up to Ohio about 2003 and have been here for the last dozen or so years, continuing to work on sort of understanding social movements and voting rights and to do my little part for making this world a little bit of a better place.
So what are you working on from, what are you teaching about these days, and what are you researching and writing about these days?
So a couple things. I'm always teaching sort of undergraduate and graduate seminars on sort of the civil rights movement, the Black Power movement, social movements, and kind of American democracy. But my research interests are constantly changing and evolving. And so right now I'm actually working on my first book, let me say, was on the civil rights movement and Black Power movement in rural Alabama and the original Black Panther Party. And my current book project is actually on New York and a black working class in New York and looking at the experiences of the black working class through the prism of the residents of Ebbets Field Apartments. For those in the New York area, remember, sort of the Brooklyn Dodgers, the housing complex that was built on the footprint of old Ebbets Field. And sort of, in other words, carrying forward some of the interests and the ideas and the experiences of folk during the civil rights movement to see, well, what happens after the 1960s? What happens after this heyday, which is, you know, connected to the conversation that we're kind of having today about voting rights, because these issues don't suddenly, all problems aren't suddenly solved in 1965, certainly not in the South and not in New York or anyplace else. And so really exploring, well, what are the issues? How are people living with them, reconciling them, trying to give full meaning to these new rights gained and the like?
So, Professor Jeffries, help our listeners and help me. I mean, I know that there was a recent, first of all, we got the anniversary of the Voting Rights Act, and then we also have a Supreme Court decision which made some changes in that. So could you give us all a primer on, and I'm just going to tell you, we're not taking three credits. This is like the, this is the 45-second version, okay?
50 years ago, Lyndon Johnson signs the Voting Rights Act, which essentially gave the federal government various powers, and the Justice Department in particular, various powers to make sure that the voting rights of African Americans were being upheld. Particularly in the states of the former Confederacy, where the majority of African Americans were still residing 50 so years ago, and their right to vote was being abridged, you know, by county registrars, by various instruments such as the literacy test. You had to pass these literacy tests and understanding tests in order to register to vote, which essentially disenfranchised millions of African Americans.
Now, so, Professor Jeffries, let me help our listeners, because I think what I heard you say is they didn't give the Justice Department the rights in all 50 states, but only in a certain bunch of them?
And yes. And this is so.
And I guess that's why, let me just interpret for our listeners, I guess that's why some people say that some states were being picked on, and that was a basis for some of the recent lawsuits?
Exactly. So they came up with a formula that was based on the turnout in the 1960 election or so. And it had looked at or took into consideration who voted, how many people voted, and the like. And based upon the outcome of that formula, a number of states and jurisdictions, including Kings County, by the way, in New York, fell under the statute that said that they cannot, these jurisdictions could not make changes to their voting procedures, because all voting administration is local, except in federal elections, locally administered. They couldn't make these changes unless they got pre-cleared by the Justice Department.
Got it. But I didn't realize Kings County was one of those that was under that order.
Absolutely. There were only a handful outside of the South, but Kings County right there in New York was one of them because of the low voter turnout and previous past episodes of fraud.
That's interesting. So now let's fast forward. Mm-hmm. What did the recent Supreme Court decision do?
So under the Shelby decision just a year or so ago, the Roberts Court ruled that the formula that the federal government had been using, the Justice Department had been using, to determine which jurisdictions needed to get this preclearance for changes, that formula was unconstitutional because, as you said, it quote-unquote picked on certain states or certain jurisdictions and not others. So in essence, what the court said was, just go back and come up with a fairer formula. But the reality is, given the current political climate, although the Voting Rights Act had been reauthorized several times by both Democratic and Republican-controlled Congresses, the reality was, in this political climate, it simply wasn't going to happen. And so by tossing out the formula and saying, just come back with another one, essentially the teeth of the Voting Rights Act had been cut.
So let me see if I understand this, and hope this is not too technical for our listeners. Now, when those things happen, either those formulas are in the statutes or they're in the regs that the Justice Department developed. Were these formulas Justice Department or were they statutory?
They were statutory.
Statutory. So I mean, you can't get a new stop sign past this Congress. So no way we're going to get a new formula.
Precisely, and that's the rub. Mm-hmm. So and in fact, the court actually made a very good point, a very good argument, and that was, wait a minute, there has been change, and you shouldn't just pick on sort of the states of the South. You know, my argument, Monsignor, is that they're right in that sense. When you look at a state like Ohio, you know, we ought to be falling under the purview of some of these preclearance statutes because of some of the shady legislative maneuvering that has been going on in Ohio, Indiana, other places outside of the South. If anything, the formula, if it could possibly, if one could imagine Congress actually doing something and passing a new statute for a new formula, it should be more expansive. It should incorporate states outside of the South. But unfortunately, that's so far from a possibility right now that it's a real shame.
So, Professor Jeffries, let me just ask you this very practically. I mean, I think what a lot of people would say is, okay, we understand some of the stuff. We've seen some of the movies, how they prevented particularly Afro-Americans from voting. They came up with these things, and people would say, yeah, that was awful, it was bad. But haven't we changed? I mean, and I think what you said is really interesting, is that we now come up with subtle ways of doing things. What are some of the, and let me use, maybe the word is a little pejorative, but what are some of the tricks that some of the districts are currently doing to make sure that certain, or to make it harder for certain groups to vote?
Well, we've seen it, and not just at sort of at the extreme local level or the county level, but really in the last 4 or 5 years, state legislatures have passed a number of new statutes to sort of regulate voter registration, and I'm sure your listeners are familiar with new voter ID requirements.
Right.
And on the surface, on the face of it, you say, well, you know, most people have, almost everybody has a driver's license. We don't see what the big problem is.
Right.
The goal, though, and this is where you mentioned, you know, things have changed. Absolutely. You go back 50 years, the goal of these restrictive voter requirements and the like, that was to disenfranchise an entire population,
right,
entire communities. What we see now, the effect and really the intent, and it's not very secretive, is not to disenfranchise an entire community. You really don't need to do that anymore. It's to sort of pick off just a couple. I mean, 5,000, 10,000, 20,000, 30,000 voters, if it becomes difficult for them to vote, to participate in the political process in a state like Florida, in a state like Ohio, you can win the presidency.
Right.
And so we think about, you know, how difficult it is it for, you know, to go get a driver's license. Well, if you're poor, you don't have a car, you're elderly, you're a student, these new types of restrictions or requirements really become restrictions. And they have, and the effect that they have is to make it more difficult and impossible for some to participate. And that some, unfortunately, is just enough in many of these swing states, critical states, when it comes to these major elections.
I think that's a really, really, really good point. Let me shift a little bit, okay? Let me shift a little bit. And let me just say this in a little bit of a way that's kind of playing the devil's advocate. You know, I don't see this as a big deal in terms of, like, getting more people registered to vote. Isn't the problem that those who registered, who could, don't even show up to vote?
Yeah, you're right. In the sense that the big problem in America is not that, is not a question of fraud or even getting people to register. It's that people, Americans, don't vote. Right. I mean, the reality is, and it's a sad reality about our democracy, is that most people do not participate. So you would think if that's the case, and I agree that that very much is the case, and it has a lot of and the reason for it are numerous, including sort of somewhat apathy, but really people making a political statement that they don't think participating in the political process is impacting and affecting their lives the way they want it to be. But if that is the case, why are we making it therefore more difficult for people to register? We need to be doing, regardless of one's political beliefs or political affiliation, we need to be doing everything possible to make it easier for people to participate in the political process, to register to vote, to be engaged and energized, and not more difficult.
Now, Professor Jeffrey, since you do all this writing stuff, you do this teaching stuff, I just talk a little bit on the radio for an hour a week. So I'm going to give you an idea, which you're free to steal and to. So here's my idea. First of all, we kind of make it mandatory, okay? I would move all voting probably to a Sunday, okay? And the third thing I would do, kind of part of the mandatory thing, I'd give a tax credit for people who voted. And that way, let's see what we could do to up the number of people who are voting.
Yeah, I agree completely. There's no reason why we ought not incentivize.
Right.
A tax credit would be a great idea, incentivize it, but then also make it more convenient. As you said, move it away from a Tuesday or work day of the work week. Move it to a weekend. There's no reason why we can't do it. You know, same day registration, get rid of these silly voter ID requirements. I mean, there are mechanisms that we can do that would, as you said, incentivize, but also make it easier. But then we also, I think, Monsignor, we have to increase our civic education. One of the things that came out of the civil rights movement wasn't just teaching people how to mobilize voters or get people to the polls. And every political party, the major political parties, are really good at doing that now. But it was about political education.
Right.
And I think an educated electorate is an informed electorate and an electorate that participates. And that has to be added to the mix as well.
I agree with you completely. And Professor Jeffries, if they only gave me one political court decision I could overturn, it wouldn't be the voting rights one. It would be the one Citizens Union on unlimited. I think, quite frankly, one of the reasons why voting is so depressed is it doesn't, it doesn't make a difference if you can't give or bundle $1 million to give to a candidate. You don't get a seat at the table.
No, you're absolutely right there. I mean, we're going to be living with the consequences of that decision, which essentially said that corporations are people and can give whatever amount of money they want. It's sort of freedom of expression. And that's just terrible because it has tilted the scales so far away from tilted scales and so far in favor of large donors and large corporations that people are right in feeling that their individual voice is not being heard.
Yeah. Now, Professor Jeffries, you have been so great in giving us time here on Just Love. I just want to thank you so much. But so how far along are you on the, I'm going to call it, I don't care what you call it, I'm calling it the Ebbets Field book.
The Ebbets Field book. I'm still in the research phase. And so I'm headed to Brooklyn every chance I get, and I'm interviewing residents, past and present, not only of Ebbets Field, but then also in the Crown Heights area.
When you're ready, will you come back and talk to us about the Ebbets Field book?
Monsignor, I would love to. I'll certainly take you up on that.
Hey, great. Professor Jeffries, who is the associate professor at Ohio State University, Department of History, we're talking about voting and how we have to get out the vote. Thanks so much for being with us, Professor Jeffries.
Absolutely.
Come back.
Take care.
Great. Tom, I think we got you. Do you vote?
I do. I vote in every election, Monsignor.
Got to check with Angie. Angie, did you register up here?
No.
Better do
it. It's been 2 months.
But you're living here now.
Yes.
And the election's coming up.
Oh, I need to.
Yep. And it's very easy. So you got to register. We'll give you 2 weeks.
I have a deadline now?
Yes.
Okay. At least I'll actually do it now.
Right. 2 weeks, but you got to register. Register. It's easy to do. Easy to do.
It really is.
Can you do it online?
I've only done it. I've not done it online myself, Mr. I've only done it on paper, but I think you might be able to do it online. You could certainly Google
online.
It.
Hey, you know what? Here's the deal, Angie. I just moved. I just moved in the new year, only about 6 months ago.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I have to re-register, do I?
Are you in the same district?
No.
You
well, I maybe if you're only voting for a representative of New York, but I think you might not have to.
No, I mean, I got to vote. I'll be voting for a different council person, a different federal representative.
I think you have, at least in Texas, I had to.
Okay. I'll make the deal that I'll take care of mine within the next 2 weeks. You got to go register in the next 2 weeks.
Deal. I like this.
Okay. That's good. That's cool.
That's a pretty good deal. That's a pretty good
what
deal.
What about Tom?
No, I'm already registered. That's it. I'm already registered. Yeah,
he's registered. So what's your favorite ice cream cone? Call it. Oh, what's your favorite ice cream?
Vanilla.
Vanilla is great. I love it. I'm cookies and cream.
I sense that.
Yeah, cookies and
you
cream.
You seem like how about you, Tom?
Mint chocolate chip.
Ooh. Oh, that's what my dad likes.
Yeah, that's uppity, that mint chocolate chip. Anyway, thank you for being with us on Just Love. Just do it. Just love God. Just love your neighbor. Love yourself. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is Just Love. Join us again next week on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
Listening to the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.